One of them wanted to be the security guy. He claimed he was a security guy.
There we go. Okay. Hey, welcome back, everybody. It's been, Jarvis, it's been a while.
Yeah, it has.
And you know why?
I know why.
You know why.
Yeah.
Few select friends know. I'm back on Facebook, everybody, because first Facebook was hacked right around Thanksgiving, and I found out I had 100 new friends that I never knew about from all over the world that just became friends, and I tried to turn it off. And then when I told Facebook I'd been hacked, I don't know what that did. It set off some chain reaction, and it literally locked me out for almost 3 months.
Wow.
And I just tried it today when we came in by chance, and it worked. And then the second thing that happened is I broke my leg. In the new Security Guy Radio Studios right down the hall here, very small studio, trying to go 5 days a week, still be with UBM, but I just wanted to announce that. Well, some more information on that pretty soon. But I was up almost at the bottom of the hour. We're going to show you the grotesque, awesome pictures of the of the break in the fall, but we're going to do that at the bottom of the hour. But I was just hanging a blanket, a sound blanket on the wall, and I don't know. I reached for this hook, and the ladder fell out, and it twisted it, and the bone popped out, and paramedic rescue and everything. 4 hours of surgery, 13 pins, not nice. But Jarvis, the show must go on.
It must go on.
And here we are.
Yes. Right?
So speaking about hackers and cyber threats and all that kind of thing, we're going to have a double whammy, hopefully a double if I get through the second show today, because my foot, if you guys can see it, I gotta hold it up here, see? I gotta keep it propped up because blood fills up. But if I can get through that, we'll have two shows. Our first guest is gonna be with Wearatech.com and then Cyber Reason. So let's bring in Mr. Ted Gutierrez from Cyber Threat. Hey, Ted.
Hey, how are you? Good to talk to you again.
Good.
Hope you're feeling all right.
I'm doing better. And how's Sharice doing?
Doing pretty good.
Working on an attack right now.
She's in the Security Operations Center right now, responding to a couple incidents. Yeah. So she asked me to fill in. I'm more than happy to do so. Long time no talk.
How dare they attack during the security guard?
I know. A cybersecurity company having to respond and take care of cyber threats.
We're going to have to do something about that.
It's about that time overseas. So, you know,
well,
everybody is starting to look at what they're going to hack today.
Well, let's get right into our guest. We got James Lee from Wearatech, Wearatech.com. Welcome, James.
Good evening. Glad you're back.
Now, we were going to see each other at Black Hat, but some kind of scheduling glitch. We didn't make that, but I'm glad you could make it today. So tell us what Wearatech does, because I find this stuff really interesting. And I got Ted to use the part of my brain that I don't use or can't use to fill in this technical stuff, but I will break it down for my nieces and nephews into lay terms and make this work for everybody. So go ahead. Tell us what you do.
Yeah, so we're an application security company. So it's sort of most basic level. But what we do is try to review every single transaction that comes into an application to determine if it is credible and it's trusted, it's permissible, and if so, then it moves forward. If not, we block it and send an alert to the company who is running the application, because applications are where the attack successful today are occurring.
In the applications themselves.
Yeah. So if you think of the security model we've used for, you know, since there's been an internet, it's always been on basically the same principle of medieval warfare. You know, we thought of everything as a castle. You keep everything with a big wall, with a thick wall and a moat and alligators and everything you can put around the perimeter. But if somebody ever got inside, there's not a lot of defense. And we modeled our internet defenses on those same principles. And over time, they evolved. And we then started shrinking that same concept of a wall from the traditional network firewall down to now what we call a web application firewall. But it still has the same vulnerabilities.
So when I was reading up on this, and I think, Ted, you and I talked about this a little bit. I forgot what the term is, but in essence, you're kind of putting the application inside a box? Is that a good way to describe it? And the box it shrinks the firewall down to a real specific place around that application, and then you can do transitions within the box, and if you're not verified, you can't get inside the box. Is that a good way to put it in simple terms?
Yeah, in the simplest term, we're a container.
where container, okay.
You take you put everything that is within the application as it's running, so everything's done real time.
Right.
You put it in a virtual container. And so if there's an attack that comes, it's going to hit the container. It's not going to actually make it to the application itself, and which is exactly where, you know, the malicious attackers want to get. They either want to use that application to get to some other data that they can extract and go and sell, or some other way use to perpetrate another attack, or they want to take over that application to find their way throughout an individual network. So this container that we create with a virtual container stops all of that from happening.
Now, when you say app, refresh my memory, app meaning application, meaning the traditional mobile sort of thing, or, well, now desktops are kind of merged with apps too. So,
yeah,
I mean,
everything,
how about
everything,
I mean,
what if everything I did, runs on an app today?
Yeah. So what if what if I applied this to Quicken on my desktop? We're not talking about that.
We're not talking about that. We're talking about when you're sitting at home and you're trying to interact with your favorite online retailer. You're doing that through a series of apps. And then once you actually get to the retail site, even within their network, they're running a series of apps that you never see.
Well,
so there's
true.
Both customer-facing apps and there's internal apps, and we can protect both.
Very interesting.
James, do you work with the with your clients on actually development of their own application to build in security, or are you looking at more of like a rerouting or filtering service that layers outside of their application software?
That's a great question, you know, because we can work with people while they're developing it. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, because that's probably one of the biggest questions people have today in the information security profession is, what's the right level of secure code? When I'm writing code, how secure do I have to make it? And of course, everybody wants to make it 100% secure. But as we were talking about a moment ago before we got started, most companies today don't write much of their own code. So they write about 10% of the code used in an application. Now, that may be a very complex, and it's obviously a very important 10%. But the other 90% comes from a variety of sources. It comes from third-party libraries, from central repositories. It comes from code that you download off the internet. It may be code that comes with the platform that you're running.
And regardless of where it comes from, it increases complexity, right?
It does. And so what we're able to do is protect all of those layers of that application stack. So when you think about the traditional approaches to application security and even network security, mm-hmm. you can only protect those parts you know are vulnerable, and you look for patterns. You're basically engaging in guesswork. But by putting the entire application in the secure container, we don't have to guess, because we see every single transaction before it executes. So before that transaction is completed, we have a chance to review it and
see
if it's
safe. So you're actually looking at almost the preventive side rather than detection and response, then.
It is just to that side of response.
Just to
you're
that
right.
side, right? No, that's where we see a huge play in the market. I mean, everybody from national governments to major corporations. I mean, all the buzz we hear is that 2017 is going to be a breakout year for security, application security, network security, and everybody's moving more to that kind of that model that you've outlined, is that everything has to be secured in some way, shape, or form in order to be successful these days. It's actually imperative, right?
Well, it has to be. What we've done for the last two decades has not kept us at pace with the bad guys. You know, at a previous company, we had a breach, and we always said then that, you know, the bad guys only have to be right once. We have to be right as the company every time. And that kind of paradigm just does not work. It's not scalable. And the number of attacks, and because of the just this explosion of applications, the coming explosion of the Internet of Things and the industrial Internet of Things.
Sure.
Human beings can't keep up with that pace. You can't hire enough developers and security professionals in an organization to be able to fix all the code that you know is wrong, look for code that you think may be wrong, It's just a, it is, it's a fool's errand to believe that all of that can be done on the front end or on the back end. So we have to find a different way of doing it. And at least we believe virtualization, which is what allows us to create this container, is the best way to do that.
Sure.
All right. Sure, so this is called real runtime application self-protection. That's the acronym we use for it, right?
Yeah, that's, now, that's the technical term for it.
Yeah,
that's right.
So now when I got into this stuff years ago, I got my own computer in 1984. Ted's heard this story, so take a nap, Ted. But I've had it for a long time. It was an 8086, two floppy drives, literally. One was the application, one was your programs and stuff. And then, you know, I've watched all this stuff develop, and I kept scratching my head years ago saying, you know, how come if a bunch of coders get on there and use 90% public access code, they don't, the first line of code, they don't lay down is security. And people tell me, well, they're developers. They don't care. What do you mean? How can they not care? That's not their job. Their job is to write the code, and somebody else's job is to secure it. And so I'm trying to put this in layperson's terms. What we're finding here is that all these applications on my phone, and I got hundreds of them, right? They probably didn't really sit around and think about or care that somebody's going to hack into their program once it's on your phone. And so now your system here is coming after all these things have been developed, putting them inside this container and making them safe. Why has this not been, and maybe Ted, you can speak to this too, why has this not been some kind of a, I don't know, mandatory, you know, application development code that says you have to do this, or we won't put your application on my Samsung unless you make it secure? That part I don't get. I'm all capitalistic and I understand free markets, but the security to me really just kind of, it bothers me that it's been so lax.
Well, that's what happened with the DYN. A denial of service attack in in what that was in October, I think, James. What you had is you had a ton of consumer applications that are out there running on consumer level products that are gaining a competitive advantage by offering something to the consumer world in the tech space that costs probably a lot more time and money and energy, namely time, to secure. And they said, well, we're not going to build in cybersecurity controls into this. We're just going to run the software, let it go. And I mean, that is, in my opinion, the fastest way. Yeah, maybe you can grow your sales, but they didn't put a lot of built-in security features in. James, your take.
Oh, I think that's exactly right. Security, it's not the fact that it's an afterthought, because every developer would love to be able to build security into it, but that's not what they're compensated on. That's not what they're incentivized to do. They are incentivized to get the application built on time, on budget, with all of the features and functions that their consumers, their customers, are going to want. Yep. And their view is, if I have time, I will do the maximum that I have the time and ability to do, but there's always going to be somebody else who will come around behind and fix it. And that's well known by the people on the other side of this equation. So we talked about Dyn and the attack on Dyn, and that, you know, that's the was a massive denial of service. Was using the Internet of Things. There were literally hundreds of thousands, if not a million, different webcams and DVRs and baby monitors, you name it, anything that they could find. And the, you know what? You know the way they found the devices? They had built a program that looked for 62 common passwords, and all they did was scan.
Oh, wow.
For those 62 passwords. And once they had those, they could control it, because there was no security built into the software that ran those devices.
And people didn't change their passwords. So on the consumer level, you have all these problems. I mean, think about operations versus quality. Think about sales versus perfection. It's the same thing when you're building technology. I mean, everybody's trying to race to be the first to provide something.
So my Facebook was hacked, and when I say hacked, I think it really was. And now that you're telling me about your product and how these things work, I'm wondering how they get it. My theory is, when I found out I had 100 new friends I've never heard about in my whole life that actually confirmed their friends, and I didn't invite them, I thought something was wrong. So I went in and shut it all down. And then when you do that, Facebook gets mad at you and locks you out because they think you're a hacker. And literally, this is the first time I could get back into it for 3 months. Yep. So let's break this down for some of my, you know, my soccer mom friends and consumer folks, non-technical, and how WearTech can help what they use at day-to-day basis. And maybe you could run us through how somebody could have hacked my Facebook, you know, because Facebook uses a lot of other apps. Facebook is pretty secure, right?
Yeah.
But these love other things, these add-ons for doing photos. And I try not to use that anymore. But explain how that route might have happened.
Yeah. Sure. And it's whether you're a consumer or you're a business, there are two things that you should always, always either do yourself personally or ask the company you're doing business with. The first one is manage your passwords. I know it's a pain in the ass. Nobody wants to deal with it. But you should always make sure your password is secure, it's complex, you don't use the same one on every account, and you change them frequently. And we hear all the time that, you know, passwords are going to be replaced at some point, and maybe that's true. But they're not replaced today. We still have to use them. So always make sure that is up to date. Make sure when you get those security updates, so if it's on your phone, the little red dot shows up, or if it's on your laptop or your desktop, or if you're a business, you know, Oracle comes out with a quarterly patch on a schedule every 3 months. There's one coming out a week from tomorrow. And whenever you see that security patch come up, patch it. That's the best way you can protect yourself. And then you get into the other kind of behavioral issues. If you're just in your personal life or something, make sure that you don't click on things you don't know where they came from. Because all the patches and all the passwords in the world can't protect you if you click on something that is really nasty. It came from somebody that you didn't know about. There was a company it was one of the world's largest oil companies. They lost their entire computer network, 35,000 computers destroyed within a matter of hours because somebody clicked on a link in spam. Wow. And they were disconnected from the world for 5 months.
They gave away oil. People don't know that.
Yeah, wow. They literally gave it away because they had no place else to put it, and they had no way to take money. They had no way to charge people for it and no way to accept payments for 5 months.
What company was that?
It was Saudi Aramco.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, was that a state action, do you think? Or it kind of smells like somebody at a state was trying to shut them down or something. We don't know.
It was in all likelihood terrorist-driven.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now, how do you think I could have been hacked in Facebook? Facebook has good security, although when my kids were in high school, they're all a bunch of little eggheads. And when it was my son's egghead friends came up and said, "Hey, Mr. Harold, watch what I can do." And he takes his phone and he hacks right into somebody's Facebook page with some kind of little trick he did. I don't know what the heck he did. And I know they've gotten a lot better from that. But I have a pretty complex password. So tell us how your application might guard, or maybe you have an example of some attempts to get into a Facebook page through an app that was, maybe the app's not around anymore, it was malicious or fake or something like that. I want people to, on the layman's side, really understand how this has been important. And to use your product, of course.
In our world, Facebook would have been our customer in this case.
Oh, Facebook would,
They would use us to make sure that anything they didn't have time to patch, they would use our product to what we call a virtual patch. They wouldn't have to go in and actually change the code. So if they knew there was a vulnerability or suspected there was a vulnerability, we could go in, put that application in that secure container we were talking about, and then it doesn't matter because every transaction coming in gets reviewed. Is it trusted and is it credible? If it's not, it doesn't go forward. So in the case of Facebook, people are able to get in, and what they do is they clone your account, usually. And once they've done that, they send out invitations from you that look real. Link those two together, then they can get into your actual account.
Now, when you say I'm cloned,
they make it look exactly like you.
But I'm not actually hacked. They haven't gotten into my system yet. They've just kind of an attack like that at Fox once where somebody put up a fake News Corp site, and they called it newscorps.com, and it looked exactly like our website. And people were sending emails. So at that point, we get these fake invitations from your friends who've been your friend for 20 years, right? It's their own independent page and account, but so far they haven't gotten into me. But when they start sending friend requests, then they match them. That's how they get me.
Yeah, that's how they get in.
Okay, very interesting. Now, Ted, we talk about this at Black Hat a lot with almost all our people we interviewed. What does real time mean, James, in today's definition? I know we're getting closer to actual real time, but are we at real time with WearAttack?
We're as close as state of the art is. So we're talking milliseconds.
Oh, good.
So it is from... Because that's always been the knock on security. So we're talking about why there's this tension between security and development. It's always been because the more security you add, the slower the application becomes. And nobody wants a slow app, right? We're impatient, you know. Those of us of a certain age remember when the greatest thing since sliced bread was you went from FedEx to a fax machine.
That's right.
That was like, oh my God, that's the fastest thing ever. Now, you know, we measure lag time for websites and transaction loads and transaction times in increments of less than a second. So when you add a lot of security, it slows things down. Because we're using virtualization, though, we don't have the same impact on the transaction load. So we can actually do not slow the application. And in some cases, because you may be running a very old application on an old piece of software, when you go into our secure container, you're now running on the absolute most up-to-date version of Java, for example. So you've actually now got this efficiencies of the current version of Java, and that then will actually, in some cases, speed up your application. So that's again, one of those wonderful little things, the side benefit of virtualization. So for the last decade and a half, we focused on putting monitors all throughout the code, and that slows things down, and it causes things called false positives, false alarms. So you'll be looking for a pattern, you'll think, aha, that looks like an attack, and then you'll go and you'll send up the red alert, and then you research and you find out, no, that wasn't an attack at all, that was actually a legitimate transaction, and I probably just lost, you know, the customer that was trying to spend money with me. So false positives are very bad. Because of virtualization, though, and you're looking at every transaction, you don't have false positives.
Oh, interesting.
This is where if there's any security people in the audience right now, they're going, yeah, right. But this is where if you look at the actual architecture of our product, and it's, again, it's just based on the concepts of virtualization. If you're looking at every transaction real time, and there's a couple of different methodologies you use to verify the credibility of the transaction. But once that's done, and all of that is done in a matter of milliseconds, you can make that determination. This is real. It's credible. It's valid. Let it go forward. And in the now 20 months we've been in live production globally, we have not generated a single false positive.
That's remarkable. Ted, is that impressive? Wow. Tell me it's impressive. Confirm.
Pretty impressive. One of the biggest challenges that you deal with from a remediation perspective is, and an incident response perspective, which is pretty much everything that happens post-detection, is false positives. And trying to figure out from a business perspective for all the business owners out there, okay, yeah, now I can see all these things. Now I have all these detection programs in place. The energy that is spent, the time that is spent, and the capital that is spent on false positives historically leave a pretty bad taste in people's, you know, sense of the usage of security, and it can become cumbersome for further innovation. So that's pretty incredible. If there's no false positives after 20 months of implementation, that's pretty incredible, man.
So let's talk about a network. I'm backing up and I'm looking at people like, you know, that I talked at Secure World or Black Hat, and they say, you know, we're looking at attacks on the network. That's not what you guys are looking at.
We're going down. A little more granular.
Is that a better way to do it? It seems like that's a better way to do it. If everything was in a box on your network, you wouldn't have to worry about all those false positives, Ted. Is that a good way to look at it, maybe? Or is that not technically feasible?
It's a little bit more complicated than that because of what they're actually doing with the applications versus a network that's all communicating to each other because of the different lines of communication. Would you agree, James?
Yeah.
So not everything on the network is an application. Most is, a lot is, but not everything. Therefore, you can't put everything in a box, so to speak.
Well, and let's go back to the analogy I used earlier about the medieval castle. What was the problem with the castle? There was only one wall. So this is what we pointy-headed security types like to refer to as defense in depth. You need more than one way of defending the castle. So we have the outer wall, but now we're going to have inner walls, and we're going to have breaks
security
within
guards,
the walls.
Security guards, cameras. Yeah.
So we'll have a variety of mechanisms we can use. What our kind of product will allow people to do is to not worry about having to immediately patch something when a vulnerability becomes known and risk breaking the code, because you don't have to actually touch the code to apply our product. And you don't have to, if you're using us in the form of this virtual patch, so you can apply our protection, and then you can look at what is it going to take me to actually rewrite this application or to physically apply a patch, then you're protected already. And when you're ready, then you can go in and apply that physical patch without having to worry about the bad guys getting to you first. Because think about what happens. Oracle comes out with their quarterly critical patch update. And everybody knows, because they release it publicly. So the bad guys know at the same time you know what vulnerabilities Oracle has found and has now patched. So it's a race. And sometimes it takes organizations, large organizations, it can take them a year or all of the patches to their application.
That's amazing. Well, James, we're almost out of time, and I want to jump in and make sure we get all your website information, how we get hold of you, and all that kind of stuff. So, give us your website and how we could look more information. This is a really fascinating subject, Ted. Are you one of the few companies that do this now, James?
We are. This concept of RASP is new. Runtime protection is new. Gartner even coined the term before anybody was in the marketplace with a product. There are a series of companies. Most of them do it through the traditional instrumentation way that we talked about. So it's kind of like taking a firewall and shrink it down. We are the only company right now who are doing this through virtualization. So we're the one group right now who can offer these particular benefits that we've been talking about this evening. If somebody does want to know more, real easy to find us. Waratek.com, WARATEK.com. And all on every page of the website, you cannot escape it. There's a little button on the side that if you want to see a schedule a demonstration, or if you want a free trial, all you have to do is click on that, fill out the form, and that email comes directly to me. So I will make sure that you get taken care of.
Excellent. Well, James, fascinating, Ted. Another interesting conversation about technical
stuff. Absolutely.
I love learning this stuff.
Thank you.
It's really good. And, maybe this year I'm trying to go to 5 days a week, and maybe we can have you log in once a month and give us an update on what's going on, latest attack or something like that, and all that kind of stuff.
Although,
it'd be hard going against our good-looking Ted over here, whose name says Charisse Gutierrez on the banner for some reason. We got to fix that, Jarvis. All right, James, thanks for coming on Security Guy Radio, and thanks for coming on my first show back after several months. Been a great conversation.
Congratulations and speedy recovery.
Yes, and don't say break a leg, because I already did that. So.
Yeah.
All right. So,
see you later, guys.
Good night, everybody.
So now Jarvis is going to pull up our next guest while Ted and I here talk a little bit. I got a call today from somebody at RSA asking if I was going to RSA. You guys going? Oop, Ted, you there? Did we lose Ted?
No, I'm right here.
Oh, yeah, I got a call today. Jarvis is going to get our next guest on here. And I got a call today, and I've got a few texts over the last month asking if we were going to go to RSA. Of course, I can't do it. Are you guys going?
Well, we were actually going to talk to you about it. When is it?
I think it's February.
I think it is, too. I'm going to look it up on the internet right now. So what are you thinking?
I just can't do it, I don't think. I mean, if it's in San Francisco, I could probably I could drive up there. But I got to keep my leg up. I'll see how it goes. But people were saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, that really RSA is the bigger of the conferences like this about, with the virtual security instead of a physical security. Would you agree that's more what they focus on?
I would have to ask Charisse. I don't have any experience on the RSA conference. Let me see what they've got. USA 2016. Looks like April.
Oh, is it April? Like, well, we got time. My leg might be okay.
Be wrong. It's 2015. Yeah. Let me check here.
So we get our next guest on the phone, Ted. I want to show you this picture of my leg. And can we pull it up, Jarvis, while you're doing that? If you can.
Well, see, all I see is UBN Radio. I don't know why it's not giving you the picture.
Oh, I don't know. Well, so here's show the first one where it's in the hospital where it's bent.
Oh my goodness.
You see that one? No, no.
I can't see it now. I can't.
All right, there it is.
Hey, right. Hello.
So that's.
Hey, how you doing?
Oh, is that Israel? Hold on a second. We're showing my broken leg here for a second. We'll be right there. So. This is my leg in the ambulance. See how it's sticking out, bent like that? And then show the x-ray, Jarvis. All right. So that's my foot is at the bottom. And those pins, those 14 screws going up there with the metal pole on the side, that's my leg out broken like 7 or 8 places. Pretty nasty. So I got to be in this cast for about 5 or 6 months. So it's...
That's intense.
Yeah, it's a long time. Long time recovery. But the show must go on, as they say in the business. So now that I'm back on Facebook, I'll post all these gross things on there so people can comment and then flag me so I can get removed again, like I always do. All right, let's get into our next guest, Cyber Reason. And who's our guest here, Mr. Jarvis? You got him? All right. Oh, here we go. I'm going to pull you up in a second. All right. Israel, can you hear us?
Yep, I can. How are you?
Good. Welcome to the show. Welcome to Security Guy Radio. I'm glad we could get this done at the last minute today. So
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. You're
the CISO of Cyber Reason.
I am actually the CISO over at Cyber Reason.
And can we switch his page there, Jarvis? So he's in.
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay, that's fine. So we interviewed you. It was Bill. We interviewed at Black Hat, and I was fascinated by your model on security because you're not just doing what other people do, which is checking packages and doing boxes and things. You're doing all kinds of other analysis in real time to say, you know what, that thing that's going on over there, that behavior, that's going to be a threat. Is that a good way to describe it? And you try to stop it. It's really very close to prevention. Is that a good way to describe it?
It is. It is, in fact, a very good way to check. I think the major difference in how Cyber Reason approaches the field is really in that state of mind that what we're looking for when we're trying to detect and respond as well as stop a threat in the network is really not a malware, right? We're looking for an operation. We're looking for behaviors that are indicators of certain behavioral steps that a sophisticated attacker has to go through to achieve its goals. And once you change that state of mind and kind of refocus on what it is that you're looking for, right? You're looking for privilege escalation, movement in the network, establishment of connection with command control infrastructure, then we're actually able to leverage, you know, big data analysis to achieve this type of behavioral analysis to really uncover those complex cyber attacks.
And Ted, we talked about this at Black Hat. This is kind of a place a lot of companies are moving now. It's instead of looking at ones and zeros, they're looking at the ones and zeros in the context of
activities. It's kind of like how we look at it. It's not just identifying your vulnerabilities. It's identifying them in a business context. In this case, Israel, you back confirm this, but it's more so than just looking for a particular malware strain. It's actually looking at all the signatures left behind or that are in place that are going to leverage whatever position that hacker may have within a certain network or computer system, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, I think it might have been
it's
Bill.
It's looking at that next level, you know?
Yeah, it might have been Bill that talked about this. But I remember somebody telling us a story to this end of finding the behavior, where they saw somebody on the network where there was no behavior. In other words, somebody's logged in, they're in there, and then nothing. No emails, no, you know, nothing, no traffic, no internet logins. But supposedly he's a verified user sitting in the network doing nothing. And doing nothing turned out to be he was just kind of sitting there waiting, watching things. So this is the type of behavior we're talking about. Some actual thing that leads to a pattern of behavior inside the network or, you know, sitting there doing nothing as an indicator. And it might have been your company. I think that's what Bill had told us about that. So give us a kind of a, for my nieces and nephews who don't understand this stuff, give me a layman's view of, you know, how Cyber Reason works for an average company that would use it, how they'd use it?
Well, you know, essentially the cyber reason is a detection and response platform, right? The ability is to gather information from various endpoints and areas in the network and analyze that information in real time to uncover those behaviors that are indicative of sophisticated cyber attackers, right? Typically, when you're attacking a network, you have to go through certain stages to achieve your goal. Penetrating into a network is just one stage. It's actually a tip of the iceberg. The vast majority of an operation happens after the penetration.
Oh, after. So it's not really, can you detect things in a recon stage, so to speak, like a test on the network or something like that?
Exactly. I mean, once you've gained a foothold in a network, you want to make sure that you first don't lose that foothold, right? You maintain persistence in that network. So that's another step that you go through, because you don't want to, you know, if someone restarts their machine, you don't want this type of situation to make you lose the hard work, all the hard work that you've invested in gaining access to that network. After you have persistence, you want to make sure that you have the highest privileges as possible, because you want to move in that network, right? Typically, the point of penetration is not where your target lies.
Oh, right.
Exactly. And if you want to move, then having very high privileges is very often a must-have. Once you have those privileges, you're starting to move and you're starting to act as a network administrator. Just not the legitimate network administrator. And you're leveraging the tools and capabilities that are built into the network to move, what we call move laterally in the network, getting closer and closer towards your target and establishing more and more points. It'll allow you to maintain persistence in that. Obviously, you maintain connections with some sort of external command and control infrastructure to whom you can send out information and from whom you can receive tasks and further instructions on what to do next. So all these steps actually happen after the point of penetration, and in sophisticated cyber operations, all these steps can take months or years. And when you have a solution in place that's not only focused on identifying and picking those specific points of penetration that are transient moments in time, but allows you to gain that full visibility into the entire length of the operation, that gives you, one, better chances of detecting an advanced operation, and two, better visibility into the entire attack story, what happened from beginning to end.
Now, we hear all that, Ted, help my little brain on this. We hear all the time about these things where it takes a year to find out the guy was in there. Or, you know, it's a year later, then we find out we've been hacked, so to speak. So how does Cyber Reason shorten that period of identifying and recognizing some malicious activity inside the network?
That's an awesome question. You know, the most typical situation where organizations identify a breach is when the damage happens, right? The encounter of one of those final stages of an operation where it's really, when it's really, in most cases, just too late. You're very late to the game. So if you've missed that transient moment in time of penetration, then most chances are you're going to see it when it actually hits you.
Yeah, now, the average malware takes about, 238 days to find? And it's only because it executes a payload that it's been waiting for the opportunity to do, whether that's escalating privileges. You know, one thing that people don't understand is that hackers all over the world are very, very, very patient. They have a plan in mind, and then if something changes, if the landscape changes or they lose a certain account or a foothold that they have, then just like any other strategy game, they're going to figure out a new way to get in there as well. And they're very, very, very good at it.
Well, and so this is where my little brain gets confused.
That's why this behavioral analytics piece comes in, Chuck, because no longer is it just looking at, is this good, is this bad? It's about, well, what's this person trying to do? And what's all the traffic on my network really look like? Well, what's normal? And so it's a cat and mouse game, really.
So if I get in the network and I'm just hanging out, not doing anything bad, just, you know, I look like I'm normal. And today I decide I'm stealing all your HR files. And then HR logs it and says, oh, my files are gone. Now I know they were here yesterday. Now they're gone, or they're corrupted or something, right? So now I know he's executed his objective. can I go backwards from that now that I know who he is and find out what he did before, or is he gone? Has he erased all trace of what he's been doing?
So the reality is that, you know, if you're not prepared to this situation, you're not well prepared to this situation well in advance, then your chances of backtracking the operation when you're dealing with someone that knows what they're doing are very, very low.
Oh, okay.
If you're dealing with someone that is, you know, kind of a novice in the field, doesn't know how to cover their tracks, then obviously there's something there to look into. But if you're dealing with someone that knows what they're doing and you haven't prepared for that situation in advance, your chances are fairly low, and you need to resort to things like what do you know from an intelligence perspective rather than in terms of the chain of evidence perspective.
So tell me how Cyber Reason would, let's say, you know, UBN was, let's say we are iHeartRadio and Security Guy Radio's files start missing. Tell me how Cyber Reason gets in here and works with me as the client to help detect these things. Is this something that sits outside the network? Is it on the network? Do you work with IT guys? What are the logistics of that?
So Cyber Reason is essentially a sensor, a lightweight sensor that's deployed on organizational endpoints and servers, basically collects behavioral information off of these endpoints.
Okay.
Processes that run, users that interact with those endpoints, network connections that are opened, et cetera, et cetera. It's mostly the metadata that gets collected, right? What happened, as opposed to the actual data that was processed there. That data is collected into a central repository where two things happen. Number one, the detection engine analyzes that information on an ongoing basis. So think of an investigator asking questions, but it's an automated investigator, if you will, that's asking those questions on an ongoing basis across the entire data that comes from the enterprise, from the entire enterprise, across the entire length of history, right? So often investigators would ask, you know, start off from a basic assumption and then go into more complex questions based on what they're seeing, right? And that really what powers the Cyber Reason behavioral analytics and machine learning process, right? The idea of starting from certain assumptions, certain basic questions on the data that we're seeing across the enterprise, and then based on the answers that we're getting, pivoting, if you will, into more interesting questions and zooming into the more suspicious behaviors. So that's one thing that's happening on that engine, right? We trigger those initial detections or leads, if you will, for the investigator. The second process is once we have a set of leads that are good indicators of certain stages of a cyber operation, where we allow the investigator to understand what the full attack story was, basically giving him visibility into all the data pieces, right? All the behavioral elements that were collected from those endpoints in the past and in the past before the incident happened and after that incident happened. So you can get this full attack story, understand where it started and where it ended.
All right. So I heard machine learning on there, which I'm very intrigued by. And let's say, tell me if this works. So I'm a bad guy. I'm a low profile bad guy. Maybe I'm not executing malware. Maybe I just want to get in there and stalk some people, right? We had stalkers at the studios all the time. And, you know, you're gathering the data in real time, put in the database, it's getting analyzed, you're looking at it. Can it learn and identify me as I emerge as a problem? Or do I have to do something that's a violation of a policy or rule? So I might be sitting there just watching things, not really doing anything security-wise that's a breach except being in the network, but I'm in and I look like I'm authentic. Can the machine learn that, you know, this Chuck guy only sends emails to this one girl on Tuesday, and that doesn't look right? Can it get down to that minutia and that level?
So that's really a very interesting question. The most common analysis that we use machine learning and train kind of the machine to do, the most common use case is prevalence. What is common in a particular network environment versus what's very rare in a particular network environment? So when you look at a situation where a browser application, right, communicates over a certain port or upload certain amounts of information out there, right? Is that normal? Is that rare? Depending on the network environment when you're where you're working, right? And that's really the idea behind the prevalence use case.
Well, that's
interesting. Right, to take certain behaviors and identify how rare or common they are in a particular network environment.
Yeah, we had a guy at Fox years ago, and this was before any of this stuff was happening, and Fox did all their own internal IT stuff, right? We learned this after the fact. He was downloading about 750, I'm having a security guy moment. What's short of a gigabyte? 900 megabytes would be then 1 gigabyte, right? So he was downloading 750 megabytes of porn, but bestiality porn. Very unusual to have in a network, I must say. Porn, you know, itself does happen, but bestiality was really crazy. And he was trying to start his own website.
Wow.
And after we found this, it became evidence. And then, you know, we put them together and stitched them up and fired them. But had I had something like this, I would have known immediately that people weren't logging into Fox Sports, Fox Net, 20th Century Fox, all the things we're supposed to do at work. And, you know, downloading porn all day, I would have found that with Cyber Reason. Am I correct?
You're correct. The only concern that I would have, unfortunately, is that we see that people download a lot more porn than you think.
Oh, well, now, okay. That's true. Yeah, that's probably the common thing now. So if it's bestiality, maybe that's not normal. What's normal nowadays, Ted? Really? I mean,
what's normal now?
That's right.
That is unfortunately the case when you look at some major network environments. You see gigantic amounts. Porn access.
Well, that's true.
Who's the analyst that has the job of looking through it all?
Who is that guy?
So the idea is that my idea is basically sound. If it's that's not the environment that belongs in, it's going to find it. And by the way, if it wasn't porn, and if it was 750 megabytes, almost a gigabyte of something. Just on volume, nobody did that at the studio. You didn't have a big enough hard drive for that in the first place. And he had a whole elaborate thing set up.
Maybe it's trade secrets, you know, or maybe it's customer list.
Exactly.
Or maybe it's client profiles. I mean, that's where that exfiltration of data becomes pretty real.
Yeah, we had Star Wars 1 that was taken off an Avid and bounced around, got put up on networks for downloading before it came out. A large file that you wouldn't see on an average desktop, right? So we would have found that. So this machine learning thing, I think, is a great concept. And then you had some other things you do. Don't you have some analysts on your side of the house that are also helping look at this? In other words, you're providing the data to me. I'm the CISO at UBN Radio, and I can analyze it and interpret it the way I want. But you have some other folks, because of the background of the people who run the company, that also help look at this stuff and say, wait a minute, I think this is an emerging threat. Let's look at that, correct?
It's very much so, Chuck. We have a group of people. It's essentially wrapped up as a managed service offering. So we're actually able to complement the technology for organizations that are interested in that with a managed service from a highly trained group of people. Most of them are graduates of the Israeli Unit 8200 and the NSA. People that are highly trained in answering the question, is what I'm seeing reasonable, right? Does it make sense? Often, when you look at more sophisticated attacks, they would not necessarily scream, I'm an APT, right? And often you need someone that had been there and done that to identify those situations.
So you offer this as an additional service for additional fee, that kind of thing?
It is, yep.
Now, this is something else I was asking people over the years. So Cyber Reason knows what they know, and Black Duck knows what they know, and WearTech knows what they know, and they have their own data sets and collections of information about their customers and what's happening. And Ted, wouldn't that be great if somehow people put down all the lawyers and said, let's stick all that stuff into one place and analyze it? Will we be more safe because Cyber Reason might have one piece of the puzzle and another company who's protected by somebody else might have another, and you put those two together and it equals a state attack or it equals the next big terrorist act or something like that. Is there anything behind the scenes that goes on where companies do those sort of things to help share not customer names, obviously, right? But just the data of the attack. You know, the information on how that attack came to be, and do we study that to say, look, here's a sophisticated attack, and let's tell everybody the story so they can look for it on their network. Is that a good question?
I think the bigger question is what role will the private sector play in the future on a global scale for decreasing the likelihood and an attack on industrial control systems?
I think they have the answers far better than the government does. But of course, I'm a capitalist, and I'm all for privacy and security.
At what happened on January 5th with the Armed Forces Senate hearings. You take a look at what happens in the UK right now with governments actually communicating that that private entities and businesses have the lead on this, and that, you know, there's going to have to be more collaboration and more rules established at a national level when you have to communicate that your company or companies have been breached. There's no rules right there across the United States.
Right.
There's different state level rules. So I think the first question to answer your question, I think it's possible. Israel, I'd love, you know, hear your feedback on it. But the real question is, when all is the conversation going to start happening more? And I think, you know, from our perspective down here in Texas, whether it's dealing with ransomware or dealing with, you know, major companies starting to see the drastic negative effects of cybersecurity attacks, 2017 is going to be a breakout year for cybersecurity in every realm. And I think that you're going to start seeing more and more people talk about it. And that's the first step, Chuck.
So Israel, to my point, because the laws around the world are all different. In Germany, you can't really do much of anything as far as sharing data or saving. But the United States, we're kind of more open. And not to give away any trade secrets, but is this something you think the industry as a whole is looking at and working towards to share the patterns of attacks and document them? And you know, maybe somebody writes some code one day and says, look, if somebody does 1 through 27, that's probably going to be an attack. We could stop it now instead of waiting to get to 100.
The industry is definitely heading in that direction. There are currently two challenges that the vendor ecosystem faces. Number one, many of those sharing forums actually require each vendor to contribute a minimum amount of samples on a daily basis to the entire group to be a member of that group.
Okay.
And that is good for the very large vendors, right? But often you'd find that smaller vendors have a lot of interesting insights into that industry, innovative approaches, but they're not providing a minimum of 100,000 new samples per day, right? Which makes them, you know, kind of puts them outside of that current circle. So that's one challenge, right? How do you harness the innovation that's in the industry?
Yeah.
Right. With new organizations that may find, you know, very interesting attacks, very advanced attacks, and not your necessarily 100,000 samples a day of your run-of-the-mill variant attacks, right? And how you integrate that into that information sharing server. The second challenge is that traditionally vendors shared information that was in the form of, you know, static IOCs or indicators of compromise, and it, as in file hashes, IP addresses, domain names. The problem is that a sophisticated attacker these days consider these type of indicators totally disposable.
Oh.
Right? They generate endless amounts of file hashes, endless amounts of IP addresses, endless amounts of domain names. So the more, you know, the industry can share more and more of those static indicators of compromise, it will have very little effect over sophisticated attackers. Now, the industry has been moving to sharing more behavioral indicators that are much harder for the attackers to change, at least in short time frames. But different vendors have different formats, right, and different ways of looking into what is a behavioral indicator, right? CyberReason has its own, other vendors have their own format of describing behaviors. So the industry will have to figure out how best is it to share behavioral indicators, right? Which is something that's currently not established. So those are two big challenges on the vendor's side, but the industry is definitely going that way.
So Ted, I remember at Black Hat, I said, I feel good about this interview. I feel not good about the interview. In other words, after I interview people, I say, oh, I feel much safer. How do you feel today after these two interviews? I feel a little safer, but only because of the private sector. And now I feel very much unsafer when I think the government is probably doing absolutely nothing like this because they don't have the ability to do it. I don't see the government.
They don't have the ability to innovate either. So
that's right.
Another
that's
big play is, I mean, you look at industrial control systems, that's probably the number one concern of a government level entity. You know, if you look at SCADA systems or industrial control systems and their problems that are inherent there from a hacking perspective, and then you turn and look at your, you know, enterprise level businesses and how they operate, and then you take a look at your small businesses, now multiply that times every industry that you have, what you now have is you've complicated it. Israel talked about the vendor challenges. Now let's talk about the actual end user challenges from a government, small business, big business perspective. And we have complicated the threat vectors and the whole scheme around cybersecurity to the point that educated conversations just can't take place on a large level. And that's what complicates the whole program. Now you've got, you've got products that fundamentally do the same thing at two different vendors, but they're focused on two different industries.
Oh.
And that's why this, you know, cybersecurity as a, you know, as an industry in general has grown substantially and will only continue to grow. And it's, I think the problem is even going to become more complex, Chuck.
So is the government, not to give away any secrets there, Israel, but is the government or are governments hiring companies like yourself to do these kind of things? It seems, in a way, the best way to do it. And in another way, if I was the IT guy for the government, I'd be nervous about it because now I'm passing government stuff to a private sector, but I suppose these things work in some applications. Where's the industry going with that, working with the government? It's like Apple, right? So I kind of sided with Apple. I'm not sure I would have given the FBI the Apple stuff. I'm not, you know, we got to, it's an extreme, but if you start to erode your freedoms, then you don't have any freedoms. So what's going on with that? Do the private companies work more and more with the government, or the government's still kind of saying, hey, we're smarter than you?
So I think, going back to early 2000s when, you know, governments, at least more, you know, forward thinking governments have established their cyber mode of operation. Governments have long realized, or at least, again, more forward thinking governments have already realized that the best way to go about this new endeavor is to collaborate with this triangle of governments, you know, industry, and academia. And most forward-thinking governments have already established sophisticated think tanks that combine, you know, these three, you know, vertices of this this ecosystem triangle.
Well, it's now, good to hear. So we got about 2 minutes. So let's talk about price points. Is this a large-scale organization that can only use you because they can only afford it, or a medium-sized company? You know, where do you, who do you work with, company-wise, size-wise?
So typically, we're best suited for medium-sized organizations and above.
Okay,
that would probably be the best fit.
And how do we get a hold of you guys? It's CYBEREASON, so it's not two R's, just one.
Exactly.
And cyberreason.com. And will we just contact you to say, hey, here's my business and my size, and then you guys do an evaluation on the network and stuff, or how do you do it?
So usually once we establish a first touch point and we understand the needs and concerns, there are multiple ways to move forward. One way would be to go into a quick proof of concept process. The deployment process, by the way, since the back end of the system can be cloud-based, either on-prem or cloud, going into a POC or a lab environment can be fairly quick. You deploy a set of sensors. Those are user mode sensors, so you can deploy them just like any other piece of software in the environment or in the lab, in the production or the lab environment, and immediately start feeling the impact of what the platform is able to see and what it's able to detect.
Israel Barak, cyberreason.com. That's CYBEREASON. He's the CISO, and I'm glad we can make this last-minute connection with you guys. Just kind of came up today, and I wasn't sure I could do two shows, but I'm glad we did. So thanks for coming on Security Guy Radio. I really appreciate it. Mr. Ted, tell Sharice I said hi, and hope she
stopped her attack. Friend, thank you very much.
At Bill's whiskers are getting a little long there, dude. Looking awesome. Look like a lumberjack.
Trying to be like you.
Is that gray I see in there? Is that gray I see in that beard?
I think so. Like I said, I'm trying to be like you, man.
Thank you. I just shaved mine today. It was about 4 inches long. My son said it looked like an old...
You had to get back on that horse, man. You got to get back in there. The world needs Security Guy Radio.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you very much. All right, we'll tune in next week, Security Guy Radio. I'm going to be live from now on, and we'll give you guys updates on the new studio down the hall, and we'll go from there. So thanks for tuning in.
All right, man.
And we'll see you next week on
Security Guy Radio. Have a wonderful night.